Thank you very much. There's actually a bit of an imbalance in this program because Dr. Berger, who happens to be my brother-in-law, some of you may not know that, has been working in the field of Jewish-Christian relations ever since he, was in graduate school. And his it's his field. It's one of his scholarly fields. And in addition, he's also been at the forefront of practical engagement between Jews and Christians. So in other words, he's the one who really knows what he's talking about. My first foray into this whole topic was in a festschrift, that is a book in honor of Dr. Berger, I had to write on new perspectives on Jewish-Christian relations, so I gave my new perspective on Jewish-Christian relations, and that was my initiation into the topic. I think when you said he's published, now this book, if you want to get it, at $199 or so, don't worry about it. When they say a scholar has published extensively, okay, anyway, so by being on the panel, I could tell the story about, well, we'll talk about it. I don't have enough time to tell that joke. Okay. Academics have a very annoying habit. They like to quote themselves. So I am going to begin this session by quoting myself from that first article in order to set the background for what Dr. Berger will talk about. I am a philosopher. He was a historian. He was very excited to hear there'll be people who are of all ages. I think he thought I meant dark ages, middle ages, and so forth. Anyway, here is the... here is what I wrote. Approximately half a century ago, the Second Vatican Council embarked on a major rethinking of numerous aspects of Catholic thought, including several items pertaining to Judaism and the Jewish people. In a resultant document titled Nostra Aetate, which means in our time, issued in 1965, the Church acknowledged that other religions contain truth and holiness, urged mutual understanding and respect, and exhorted, quote, her sons to engage in dialogue and to collaborate with other religions so as to work together for the benefit of humanity. And this was an enormous, enormous, enormous change in the Catholic attitude towards other religions. I'll break that down a little bit in a little while. Now, in the aftermath of Vatican II, there have been an abundance of interfaith dialogues. And presently, Christian and Jewish thinkers widely accept dialogue as necessary, as desirable, or even as obligatory. The primary exception to this is the Rav. And Dr. Berger will be focusing his comments on the Rav. Now, since the document was issued, the Church has also abandoned or modified numerous teachings about the Jews. About the Jews in particular. It has repudiated anti-Semitism and modified the teaching that the Jews were guilty of deicide and deserved the ill fate they suffered throughout history. Many Christian theologians have abandoned the concept of mission to the Jews, proselytizing, and the supersessionist view that Christianity entirely replaced Judaism has also been repudiated by many. In addition, the Church has legitimized the State of Israel. And before reading this, I asked Dr. Berger his haskama to make sure that what I was writing there was accurate. So that's the historical background to this session. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of sort of the, I guess you could call it the philosophical background, since that is my field. And the question that... that I think we can start with is the following. Suppose I'm a member of a particular religion. What do I think about other religions? Now, I'm going to break that down, and please understand that I'm not here interested in the question of how do I know my religion is better than their religion. That's not the issue now. The issue is just how do I view them in terms of certain questions. Question number one is the question of truth, which means, are there spiritual truths, religious truths in other religions? Now, the question has to be, I think, you know, fine-tuned a little bit, because there is a position called pluralism, which comes in many varieties, but in the extreme version of pluralism, everybody's right, okay? Everybody is correct. There is no such thing as one true religion, which, of course, is very difficult for two reasons. Number one, because it does seem that if I claim, for example, the Messiah has not yet come, and the Christians maintain that the Messiah came over 2,000 years ago, there's a bit of a contradiction there. If I claim that the Hebrew Bible law has not been abolished, and the other person does, we are contradicting each other. So pluralism tends to lapse into some kind of a relativistic view. The other problem with this extreme pluralism is that it sort of denigrates the importance of any particular religious choice you make. I mean, it's like the story of this, this guy comes to his rabbi and he says, "Tell me, Rabbi, who is greater, Abraham or Moses?" The rabbi says, "Abraham." And then the guy asks him, "Oh, but Moses took us out of Egypt." Okay, so Moses, there is not too much really hinges on the question. Now, what is a more plausible version of pluralism? Well, one version would simply say that other religions have truths. But that's kind of trivially true. If I'm a Jew and I believe the world was created and the world is overseen by God, and the Christian believes the same thing, then obviously we have some commonality. So I think the real issue about truth is the following. Are there religious and spiritual truths in other religions that I do not have in mine? That's the question. And the question is also, should I try to find them? Now, I don't know how anyone would know in advance whether there are truths in other religions that I don't have in mind, but that seems to be where the action is, so to speak, in terms of this question of truth. Do they have truths that I don't have? And this has to do with some of the motivations for dialogue, Jewish-Christian dialogue, that I'm going to mention. Second question has to do with salvation. Is my religion the only path to salvation? The classic Catholic teaching was that that there is no salvation outside of the church. The general thrust of Judaism, or the dominant position, is that tzaddikei umos ha'olam or chassidei umos ha'olam yesh lohem chelek la'olam haba. You can go into olam haba even if you are not a Jew, as long as you are in this category. The question is, what is it that is going to be required of you, if you're a non-Jew, to get into this next world? Is it that you have to observe the seven Noahide laws? Now, suppose that you do, and among them is not to worship Avodah Zarah. So then the question becomes, okay, so is that other religion Avodah Zarah? Is Christianity considered Avodah Zarah? And then there's a further question, which Dr. Berger pointed out to me once, which I think is based on, is it the Tiferes Yisrael or Rav Avadia, about not having a perfect score? I have it on my article, anyway. Right. Okay, yeah, so I stole or borrowed, I'm sorry, that idea from Dr. Berger. The third question is the issue of eschatology, which means the end of days. What happens at the end of days? And each religion wants to describe a scenario that will occur. I mean, you could have a scenario in which the idea is that all the people who aren't in my religion, you know, wind up getting killed. There's another one in which they all come to me, and say, "You're right, you're right." In the Olenu, we end with the idea of "Ohayo Hashem lemelech al kol ha'aretz, b'yom ahu yihyeh Hashem echad u'shmo echad." What that sounds like, okay, I think the general thrust of it, is that the other nations will come to accept monotheism. It doesn't necessarily mean that they will convert to Judaism. Now, the Rambam uses the phrase dat ha-emet, that everybody else will turn to the dat ha-emet, true religion, and there is a machlokas between Rabbi Chaim Rappaport and Professor Menachem Kellner, which was in, I forget if it's in Ma'orot or Chakira, about the question of what does Rambam mean by dat ha-emet. Does he mean they will convert to Judaism, or does he mean that they will convert to monotheism or to something less than a full allegiance to Judaism? Dr. Berger, the funny thing is I wouldn't be calling him Dr. Berger in any other setting. I would be calling you David Berger, right? I'd be giving a lecture somewhere else. So I'd say David Berger says, but here, I don't know why I'm calling you Dr. Berger. That's right, in private. Let out a family secret. We address her as Dr. Berger and Dr. Schatz. It's out of the bag. The secret is out of the bag. Okay. We mean it. Okay. In fact, I once called and I said, "David," he said, "is something wrong?" So now Dr. Berger has pointed out that You know, one of the considerations that you have to take into account here in connection with eschatology would be the question of sort of whether you want everybody to become Jews. In other words, is this a kind of universalistic thrust, you know, that everybody can do what they want as long as it's under a monotheistic banner? Or is the idea to kind of protect Judaism from the non-Jews coming in? And that's a question. Do you look at it as universal or particularistic? There are lots of other sources that are relevant to this question. Now, the next item on my list says missing one question mark. So I don't remember what I had in mind with that. But the last one I have is relevant to this discussion, and that is practical questions. You know, so far we have truth, salvation, eschatology. The last one is a whole host of questions about social interaction on many levels. Do you accept converts? Do you proselytize? Or do you try to win converts? How strenuous an effort do you make? Do you engage in interfaith dialogue, which will be the subject coming up very shortly? How do you deal with intermarried couples? Another sort of practical question. I mean, there are a lot. Do I go to a wedding where a family relative is intermarrying? And so on and so forth. These are the practical issues, and the ones that are most relevant to today are proselytizing and dialogue. Now, why is it that many people, you know, favor dialogue? As I said, the large majority believes in interfaith dialogue. Now, there are a number of different reasons which I would break down into social reasons or social goals and theological goals. And that distinction between social and theological is very important in the Rav. First of all, some argue very simply that this is an age of globalization. And in an age of globalization, you simply cannot separate yourself from other people. There's no such thing as real isolationism. So it's a kind of necessity thrust upon you by the structure of society. A second social argument, which can be related easily to the first, is that dialogue promotes amicable relations and social solidarity. Now, that could be good in itself, just, you know, it's wonderful to have shalom for its own sake. Or it could be that there are pragmatic reasons for it. For example, that the dialogue would be best for the flourishing of my group, given that it will promote amicable relations and social solidarity. Some of these classifications, I actually was influenced by an article by Rabbi Tzvi Blanchard, who's a pro-dialogue article, and there's a strong similarity between what I did and what he has, and I'm kind of indebted to the article, but I changed certain things. Okay, the second is that dialogue curbs fanaticism and extremism. And Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, I believe, has sort of pushed this argument in one of his books. It might be in The Dignity of Difference, I'm not sure. A third kind of social argument is that if you have dialogues of a certain sort, then religious groups can get together to combat social problems like poverty, disease, inequality, oppression, secularism. And that's really where the Rav will come in, because that's a form of dialogue which the Rav not only permitted but thought was actually imperative. Finally, and this is very so closely related to three, I don't know whether to distinguish it, that religious political coalitions can get, you know, coalitions between different religions can get things done in society that are important for religion generally. Someone who is at the forefront of public policy positions in the Orthodox community simply told me, he said, realistically, nothing gets done without coalitions. If you do not have a coalition of the different religions, you're not going to be able to accomplish your goals. You can take things like school vouchers or other issues. As long as the religions agree on where you stand, there would need to be some sort of cooperation. So again, those are the social political goals that are urged by those who favor dialogue. The theological goals can be broken down as follows. Some say, and here again Rabbi Blanchard's article is very helpful, that there is an obligation. Okay, now we're talking here not simply that it's okay or whatever, that there's an obligation, it said, to learn about the other. To learn about other people. Now, this word, the other, has become a big scholarly word, usually capitalized, and there's now a verb called othering. That's what it is. You know, it's when you make somebody different from you, you draw an us-them line. So there's an obligation to learn about the other. Why is there such an obligation? Well, if you learn about the other, it's going to curb hatred and violence, supposedly, by preventing demonization of the other. Of course, you never really know that's going to be the result, but that is what is expected. But now there's a different thing, not a learning about the other, but learning from the other. And this is especially important in the kinds of theological dialogue that are going to be at issue here. Now, what is good to learn from the other? Well, it could be good in itself. Maybe you want to say no one has the whole of religious truth. Sometimes you might break this down into explicit discussions of ideas versus what they call the narrative model, where I don't come in and sort of present my positions, I talk about my experiences, and that's a different thing where you're not really pushing a particular proposition, you're just trying to inspire other people in a religious path. I think the word obligation, my opinion is the word obligation here is very, very strong, and I think maybe not warranted, but that's a different story. You're not obligated to seek every possible truth in the world, and you might want to distinguish the religious truths, other truths, and so forth, but I think that there's what to talk about there. I have two more left on this list, or three. Dialogue can enhance one's self-understanding as an adherent of his or her religion. Now, this approach has been taken by Professor Michael Visegrad, one of the important Jewish thinkers, who says that, for example, he's been able, through Jewish-Christian dialogue, to appreciate better the contrasts between his own religion and other religions. And that way he has a greater appreciation of his own religion. In particular, I think the example he gives is the emphasis upon law. Then the next one is that dialogue can enhance understanding of your religion for a different reason. Not because you're contrasting it to the other religion, but because you might see somebody of another religion has an idea, and then you find it in some Rishon or something like that. Then you're going to, say, hey, that's a minority view in my, not well-known view in my tradition. Maybe we should look at this more closely. Maybe it should be more important. Maybe I should trace it and look for other people who say it. And the last one, which I want to elaborate on, exposure to other visions, such as eschatological visions. Visions of what will be at the end of days can affect ethical decisions in valuable ways. Now, without elaborating too much on that, I just want to mention that one of the points that's often made in discussions about messianism or eschatology is that the way you conceive the messianic age or whatever period you're talking about at the end, so-called end of days, the way you conceive it is going to reflect certain values that you have. So, for example, if you look at the Rambam, the idea is we will have peace and security, and therefore we will be able to learn and to study and have intellectual growth. That is a certain vision. In fact, in the 19th century, the liberal Judaism is reformed Judaism. Essentially, since they weren't going to believe in the coming of a personal Messiah, the emphasis there was on understanding what ideals Judaism's view of eschatology reflects. My last point before Dr. Berger takes the stage here is that I think there's a certain tension between two things that are going on here. One is, the first thing I want to say here is that the article that I was quoting from is an article in which I try to argue that even the critics of the Rav should really wind up agreeing with him. In other words, I have a sort of intricate argument basically to show that it's very difficult to avoid taking the Rav's position on theological dialogue. The point I want to make is that it's interesting we have two different trends in the society today. One is the idea that communities are isolated, they have certain, very strong sense of identity, everybody is distinct, and everybody sort of says, oh, okay, your group is fine, your group is fine, your group is fine. And on the other hand, you have these calls for mutual understanding. Mutual understandings would seem to involve some kind of interaction. And once you have interaction, then it would seem that the next step would be influence. So I think there's a certain tension there. And at this point, I turn it over to the person who really knows the subject. Okay.
I always hate it when somebody prefaces a question to me by saying, You'll know the answer to this question. Now I've been introduced in an even more daunting way. I know this topic, the whole topic. I also want to tell you immediately that if you think that our addressing each other as Dr. Schatz and Dr. Berger is a family secret indicating silly behavior, you should only know the other secrets.
Come next year.
Right. Let me begin by saying that the Rav's position on this question is not simple. There is this notion that the Rav opposed dialogue with Christians. Stated in that form, that's not true. The Rav, as Dr. Schatz noted, explicitly approved of dialogue regarding social questions. I think that if we ponder carefully the list of positive outcomes of dialogue that we just heard, many, indeed most of them, can be achieved by the sort of dialogue that the Rav approved. Amicable relations, curbing fanaticism and extremism, getting together to combat social programs, working with Christians will accomplish things that you can't accomplish on your own. And with respect to vouchers, by the way, the Aguda also works with Christians on that issue. As far as the theological issues are concerned, one can achieve most of them, if not all of them in part, without formal dialogue between religious communities. You can learn about the other through reading, through attending lectures, through going to classes. You can learn from the other to a non-trivial degree in a similar way. You can enhance self-understanding in a similar way. Michael Wishart wrote an article, "What Have I Learned from Karl Barth?" He didn't carry out dialogues with Karl Barth. Uncovering minority views. That can also be done without formal interfaith dialogue, and the same is true of exposure to other visions. Now, I don't argue that you can't accomplish some of these things more effectively by formal interfaith meetings among groups. I think that to some degree, in some cases a marginal degree, you can. But then you have to weigh the benefits against the dangers. Now, let me start, or continue, by citing the Rav's, or actually quoting a few lines, from the Rav's most radical formulation of opposition to theological dialogue. The word of faith, he said, reflects, I'm quoting from Confrontation, his talk and later essay on this issue that emerged out of the environment of the Second Vatican Council. The word of faith reflects the intimate, the private, the paradoxically inexpressible cravings of the individual for and his linking up with his maker. It reflects the numinous character. I had to translate that word into Hebrew. That was a challenge. The numinous character and the strangeness of the act of faith of a particular community, which is totally incomprehensible to the man of a different faith community. Hence, it is important that the religious or theological discourse should not be employed as the medium of communication between two faith communities whose modes of expression are as unique as their apocalyptic experiences. The confrontation should occur not at a theological, but at a mundane human level. There, all of us speak the universal language of modern man. And he then goes on to speak of the areas of agreement that we have. Although he then sticks in a sentence, which has to some degree caused particular criticism, the great encounter between God and man is a wholly personal, private affair, incomprehensible to the outsider, even to a brother of the same faith community. Now, I should tell you, by the way, that there is a footnote in here when he talks about social issues, a famous, very brief footnote in which he says that to the man of faith, you know, his term secular orders that he used, which I didn't read that sentence, is a misnomer, because to the man of faith, God claims the whole, not a part of man, and people have argued that this shows that you can't make the sharp distinction that the Rav seems to make. So, let me say that the Rav's assertion here cannot and clearly does not mean that doctrinal information cannot be conveyed to somebody else, let alone another, a member of your own faith, but even to a member of the other faith. The Rav learned a very great deal about Christianity from what he read about it, and to some degree from interaction with Christian professors and so on. The Rav is referring to the depths of religious experience that he believes cannot be fully transmitted. But even with respect to doctrinal discussion, he worried that dialogue between faith communities, and I keep repeating that phrase which comes from him, because I think there is a big difference in the Rav's thought and in reality between conversations between individuals or even groups that don't represent the faith community and formal dialogue between members of that community. I think that the Rav believed, it's very clear that he believed, that dialogue between faith communities could actually exacerbate tensions as irreconcilable differences come to the fore. The Rav, in confrontation, refers to three related concerns of his that go beyond this theoretical position of incommunicability. I'm paraphrasing here, in the interests of time. First, the majority community, he said, should not suggest to the minority community that it ceased to exist. That's one way of saying that there is a concern about missionary, conversionary intentions on the part of Christians. Two, Jews should not interfere in Christian rituals, beliefs, or texts. We should not be telling them what they should believe or how they should worship or what their texts mean. Three, we should not even hint at a willingness to trade theological favors. We'll see an example or two of that as we go on. Now, there are a good number of people who argue that these concerns of the Rav are no longer relevant today. This is a post-Vatican II age, and not only post-Vatican II, which was in the mid-60s, but it's, I mean, the Rav gave this talk before the document Nostra Aetate was adopted by the Catholic Church, and since then there have been further developments in which the Church formally has said somewhat nicer things about Judaism than you even find in Nostra Aetate, and hence we have some, a non-trivial number of influential Orthodox Jews who claim that the Rav would not maintain this position anymore. Some of them have even argued that he didn't maintain the position as I outlined it even then, but they're wrong. Even assuming that they're right, which they're not, the argument is that he would have changed his mind today because things have changed so radically. Now, things have changed. They have. And I do not at all minimize the significance of Nostra Aetate and the statements that came afterward. I think that there is an untoward tendency on the part of many Orthodox Jews to react to this development as follows. First of all, they denounce the Church and Christianity in general for saying these terrible things about Jewish responsibility for the crucifixion and how Jews are a rejected people how the Jews are being punished for all of this. They say denunciatory things about Christianity in general, the Catholic Church in particular, for these positions. And then when the Church changes these positions, they say, thank you very much. Too little, too late. That's wrong. I mean, I think it's wrong on an intellectual level, and it's wrong on an ethical level. But The notion that the concerns that the Rav expressed have consequently entered the dustbin of history are not true. And so let me look at some current examples with, relevant to the 3 points that I quoted in the name of the Rav. The first had to do with conversion and mission. Now, it is true that conversionary activity aimed toward Jews has diminished. In the case of the Catholic Church, there is no organized mission to Jews. But the impulse to see even dialogue as a means toward a conversion of Jews has not completely died, even among the most liberal and progressive elements in the Church. Let me begin with an example that doesn't come from the most liberal circles of the Church, but comes from a rather important source, an officially sanctioned, papally sanctioned document that appeared at the very beginning of this century, called Dominus Iesus, where it's very clear that one of the goals of dialogue is evangelization. That's the term used. There have been liberal Catholics who have attempted to say that evangelization doesn't mean mission, it means something like witness, but it's very difficult to read the document that way. That document was written by the Pope Emeritus before he became Pope, very shortly, a few years before he became Pope. But that's a pretty influential document, and it received the haskama of the then Pope, of John Paul II. More recently, conservative elements in the Catholic Church in the United States, which is as liberal a church as you would expect, spoke about how dialogue with Jews does not involve an explicit invitation to baptism, but it does involve an implicit invitation. Under serious pressure from us, pressure in which I was involved, they actually eliminated the offensive sentences, which was remarkable, and that's very important also. There are two sides to this. But we're talking about a suggestion that dialogue involves an implicit invitation to baptism that was formulated within the last decade. And even more recently, it came to our attention that the Catechism for High School Students of the Catholic Church in the United States lists as the fourth and final objective of dialogue with Jews, bringing them close to the truth. So even this is not completely dead. The second issue has to do with our interference in their rituals, beliefs, or texts. That certainly hasn't ended, and it carries with it, carried with it in the Rav's view, two dangers. First of all, he thought it was intrinsically wrong. And second, it could lead, and this will be the third point, to expectations of reciprocity on our part. I'll give you one example of this kind of interference. A very important figure in contemporary Jewish-Christian dialogue, lastly a Reform rabbi, denounced the church for some sort of statement that indicates that they expect that at the end of days, the Jews will recognize what they see as the truth. And he wrote that to suggest that Jesus is waiting for the Jews to recognize him at the end of days is somehow an anti-Jewish kind of immoral position to take. That is the kind of thing the Rav opposed, and I think rightly. I don't just think it's our business to tell them that they're not allowed to believe this any more than it's their business to tell us that we are not allowed to believe the end of Aleinu. And finally, the third issue had to do with willingness on our part to trade theological favors. And this is a real issue. When a Jewish document called Dabru Emet appeared, also early in this century, A Christian theologian, very friendly to Jews, said, it's about time that the Jews responded on a theological level to all the nice theological changes that we've made on their behalf. And I'll give you an example or two of the most sensitive sorts of issues. Is Christianity, from the perspective of Judaism, of Jewish law, avodah zarah? That's a double question. Is it avodah zarah for non-Jews? Or is it avodah zarah only for Jews? There's hardly a position that it's not avodah zarah even for Jews. When I gave an interview to the Jewish Week in a context that had to do with the New York Board of Rabbis inviting its members to a prayer service for peace at the main sanctuary of St. Patrick's Cathedral, I objected to this, and I said something about how Jewish law has differences of opinion as to whether or not Christian worship is, and I used the word idolatry, which I shouldn't have used. I should have used foreign worship. Idolatry has all kinds of connotations. As to whether it's avodah zarah for non-Jews, but everyone agrees that it is for Jews, and hence Jews shouldn't do such a thing. There was a strong objection from a leading ecumenical figure in New York, whom I knew a little bit, because after all the things that they have said about Judaism in the last years, we go around and say something like that about Christianity. That is a clear demand for theological favors, the trading of theological favors. And one other example, I could say much more about this, but one more example. There is a quip that is attributed to two distinguished Jews. I don't know who's the one who first said it, somewhere in the middle of the 20th century. But it has been repeated by at least two significant Orthodox figures in very recent years. One of whom is very involved in dialogue, the other is not. And in the second case, I have to say that the motivation is more not to offend evangelical Christians who support Israel. That one is not motivated so much by dialogical considerations. And that is that when the Messiah comes, we'll ask him, are you here for the first time or for the second time? Which kind of, you know, trivializes the matter. I wrote about this with respect to one of these people and said, who said that the Messiah, he would tell the Messiah not to answer. And I asked whether he would also ask the Messiah not to answer the follow-up question, are you the incarnation of the second person of the triune God? So we have here significant evidence of exactly the kind of impact on Judaism and on Jewish belief that the Rav worried about. And in that sense, the Rav's concerns were not outmoded, but are not outmoded, but were prescient. I have to say, however, that applying the Rav's criteria is a daunting, difficult, complex task. This is not a simple matter. There's a question often of what is theology and what isn't theology. Reminiscent of what I heard from Avraham Soloveitchik in his shiur, when we learned the Gemara that a person should listen to his wife with respect to milei d'alma, with respect to temporal matters, and a wife should listen to her husband with respect to milei d'shmaya, with heavenly matters. And the Rav Aaron said that a prominent rabbi was asked why he sometimes argues with his wife when there's this Beferish Gemara, and the answer was, that's what we argue about. Is this Milei D'Alma, or is this Milei D'Shmaya? And so you can say the same thing sometimes about theology. But I'll give you two examples from my personal experience. I was once asked to discuss the place of Jerusalem in Judaism and in Christianity at a Jewish-Christian dialogue, a dialogue that dealt with where Orthodox Jews, the OUNRCA's delegation that meets with Catholic leaders in the United States twice a year, usually. And the decision that was made by the group was, yes, I should do that, because the objective was not theological. The objective was to try to gain sympathy from them for the Jew, for the position of Israel regarding Jerusalem. Another even more sensitive, and this will be my final example, another more, even more sensitive example, I was asked by the head of the successor organization of the Synagogue Council of America, what's called the National Council of Synagogues, is that what it's called? Yeah. It's a non-Orthodox group. It consists of conservative, reform, reconstructionist rabbis, for the most part, and they were going to have a dialogue with Presbyterians. And I was told that there's some dispute within the Presbyterian Church as to the desirability of missionizing Jews. And the topic of the little conference was conversion and proselytizing in Judaism and Christianity. Would I give the main address? Now, A, it was non-Orthodox group, and B, this is theology. And I called I don't know if he would want to be quoted, a rabbi of the absolute first rank, to ask him what he thought I should do. And he this is a person who is devoted to the Rav's guidelines. And he said without hesitation that I should do it, because if it might save a Jew from Shmad, if it's a remote possibility, I should do it. If you want to see it, it's published. Let me now end with a quick story that reflects the real changes in Jewish-Christian relations in a sympathetic way. I once gave a talk on the history of Jewish-Christian relations in Boston College. Afterwards, a Christian who is a sister but is a professor and is an Ohevis Yisrael, Mary Boyce, gave a talk on some vignettes of recent Jewish-Christian relations and said that she was at an ecumenical Seder shortly before Pesach, and she was asked by four Catholic participants whether they can drink the wine because it was Lent, and they had accepted upon themselves a chumrah not to drink alcoholic beverages during Lent. And she thought for a moment, and she said to them, St. Patrick's Day also comes out during Lent. Tell me, do you drink on St. Patrick's Day? The answer was yes, and she paskined that the Seder has the same status as St. Patrick's Day. This could not have happened 300 years ago.